Okay, thank you very much, Mrs. LaRouche, for agreeing to this interview. You are the head of the Bürgerrechtsbewegung Solidarität, the founder of the International Schiller Institute, and the wife of Lyndon LaRouche. So thank you for being with us on the line from the United States today.
Hello.
Hi. We have a slate of candidates from the Friends of the Schiller Institute running in the municipal elections in Copenhagen and in Aarhus, with Tom Gillesberg as our leading candidate in Copenhagen. And our provocative slogans on our now very famous election poster is Glass-Steagall, not EU fascism. The banking union will take your money and your life. So I would first like to ask you if you would endorse our candidates and how you see the state of the world on the eve of the elections here.
Yes, I do emphatically and full-heartedly endorse Tom, because he has proven over the years that he has, with great foresight, always, put his finger on, developments to come. And while the posters may have shocked and surprised people in the relevant election campaigns, only a short period afterwards, people would recognize that he was the outstanding politician to have warned against dangers and also always showing what would be an alternative policy to the present track and trend, and what would actually create a solution and a way out. So I full-heartedly endorse him. Now, I want to say that we are right now in such a precarious world strategic situation that we need a fundamental shift in the paradigm of practically everything, because we have a multitude of dangers. One, which most people are not aware of, but which is very much there, and that is the danger of the strategic situation deteriorating into a potential global thermonuclear war. I know that the mainstream media are not talking about that, but I can only say that the recent response of the Chinese PLA to the air seabed policy of the United States, which they published in all Chinese publications last Monday.
The People's Liberation Army.
Yes. That basically China is prepared for a second strike reaction in case this air seabed conception is taking down the defenses of China. Now, this is very scary, because this is what even many institutes in the United States are now warning, that this air seabed conception in the Pacific is a provocation against China and can lead to a very quick deterioration and even war. And if you combine that with the fact that BBC just reported a couple of days ago that Saudi Arabia is actually owning nuclear weapons, which they financed in Pakistan, and that they can call to have them practically in the matter of a day or so, which is an obvious threat to the question of non-proliferation. I mean, it becomes a joke, because Iran, even if Iran would go for a nuclear weapon, and they don't have the intention to do so. I mean, actually, the P5+1 negotiations in Geneva are quite successful and promising. But if Iran would decide to acquire or to develop nuclear weapons, it would take them minimum a year. But Saudi Arabia actually possessing nuclear weapons in Pakistan means they could have them in a day. There has been almost no comment on this, but but I think it really shows how extremely dangerous the situation is, because you have to combine this, Chinese developments and what I just said about Pakistan and Saudi Arabia as being part of a very dangerous world situation. Now, that means if there is such a use of nuclear weapons, then, we are really looking at the possible extinction of civilization. It's not true that the mutual assured destruction doctrine no longer is valid, which is what some articles recently have claimed, but we are looking into a crisis which is much, much more dangerous than the middle-range missile crisis of the beginning of the 80s. Now, that's one thing. The other thing, naturally, is that there is no question that what the international financial oligarchy is intending to do with the financial crisis is to answer in the same way like it was done in the 30s, that is, with fascism. Now, if you look at the combined policies of the Troika in southern Europe, in Greece, in Cyprus, in Spain, in Portugal, and the kind of horrible austerity policy implemented in the United States right now with the complete cutting of the healthcare system, the so-called Obamacare, which most Europeans have not yet woken up to, but Obamacare means practically slashing healthcare to such an extent that it immediately will reduce the life expectancy of many people, because if you eliminate up to 80 or 90% of hospitals in rural areas, you cut the medical personnel, doctors, nurses, as it is happening right now, many people will not have access to healthcare, and informed officials in the United States are warning that if the present policies are being implemented, then in half a year from now, you simply will not have the infrastructure for any kind of healthcare giving it that name. Then if you take the fact that fact is that 47 million Americans right now are dependent on food stamps. Now, 47 million, I don't know how many times Denmark that would be in terms of population, but they are now cutting 5 billion of food stamps per year, and that means that in every month, 1 week, people will not have food stamps. Now, this will hit for the first time next week, which is the week of Thanksgiving, or the last week of November, and people who are operating food kitchens and food banks are warning that this could lead to riots, because if people have nothing to eat, then they get desperate and they do all kinds of things. So we are looking at an unbelievable strategic and financial crisis. Now, the good thing is that yesterday the American Senator Elizabeth Warren made a very important speech in a hearing in the Senate, where she said that the world financial crisis right now is much worse than in 2008, which is absolutely true. And she pointed to the fact that the too big to fail banks are now 30% bigger than they were in 2008, and that the four largest American banks now run more than 50% of all banking operations. Now, obviously, that means all the problems which existed in 2008 before the collapse of Lehman Brothers are now back there, and the danger to the world financial system is therefore much, much, much bigger than even then. So she called for the immediate implementation of Glass-Steagall, the separation of the banks in the tradition of Roosevelt, and she said there is an absolute chance that this fight can be won. David can win the fight against Goliath, but we have to take out our slingshots. Now, this is very important because, you know, I mean, it can be won. This fight can be won, and, you know, people must really understand that there is an alternative in the same way, like, you know, our movement has helped to create a big demand for Glass-Steagall in Italy. For example, just yesterday, the region of Lombardy unanimously endorsed the Glass-Steagall resolution, which was introduced 10 days ago. So across all parties, they decided that they insist Glass-Steagall law must be implemented. And Lombardy is the third largest region of Italy. We have the German, French mayor's initiative, which is growing, and people from Italy are now joining it. So there is hope, but, you know, I mean, I would be not honest if I wouldn't say that the situation is extremely dangerous, and therefore the candidacy of Tom in Denmark is really, really important.
Can you say somewhat more about how you the Schiller Institute can say that the EU is implementing fascism, and what this has to do also with the question of the banking union?
Well, I think that the if you have a system whereby you redistribute wealth in large proportions from the general population to the speculators, which is what the bailout policies of the last 5.5 years or 6 years have been, because in reality, all the bailout packages were just the redistribution of private gambling debt into state debt. And then after the states were indebted, they turn around and say, now we have to have a debt break, and now we have to have austerity programs. And, you know, therefore, you know, basically the general population, the taxpayer, has to pay for worthless gambling debt. Now, obviously, the gambling debt is much, much bigger than they can even extract from the state budgets through bailout packages. And therefore, they are now doing three things. They want to continue the bailout programs. They want to continue to print money, which is, you know, the quantitative easing in the United States, or the EZB, which has just reduced the interest rate from the particular 0.5 to 0.25, almost zero, which is money printing de facto. But they want to combine these two measures with the so-called bail-in, which is the so-called Cyprus model. That is a creditor hierarchy according to which the people who have accounts in the banks, the bondholders, are supposed to be participating in the losses with the haircut, as it was done in Cyprus. Now, this is being prepared for the entire United States and the EU. Even Schäuble, after being silent about it during the recent federal election campaign in Germany, said it publicly in an interview just last week that such a creditor hierarchy is being prepared. And given the fact that you have an outstanding debt of 1.4 quadrillion derivative contracts, so even if only in the case of crisis you would have to call in 700 billion, then, you know, this is far beyond what, you know, you could accomplish. And therefore, you know, it would really lead to a total collapse of the real economy, the living standard, exactly as we have seen it in Cyprus after the haircut. Now, the combination of these measures would mean such a dramatic cut in the living standard, in the life expectancy, as we have seen it in Greece, in Cyprus, where the life expectancy is dramatically reduced, that it's killing people. And you know, these policies kill people, and that has to be understood, and that is why they have to be rejected, because, you know, I mean, there is now in the United States, for example, a very important initiative where a medical doctor, Dr. Shelley, has issued a statement where he refers to the arguments of Dr. Leo Alexander, who was the chief medical advisor to the Nuremberg Tribunal, where he, Dr. Alexander, at that time said that it was the shift in the perception of the value of human life, that you have all of a sudden useless eaters, people whose life is not worthy to maintain, that it was that shift in the attitude which, you know, was what led to the euthanasia of the Nazis. And he says that with Obamacare and with these cuts, you have exactly the same kind of shift. So, you know, I mean, policies which honor gambling debt and high-risk gambling, which is what the derivative and the whole creative financial instrument policy is all about, if you pay for that with the life of people, then that is fascism. And that is the policy of the European Union. That is what the Troika has implemented in Southern Europe. And that is why the UN human rights responsible has basically charged the Troika with human rights violations in Southern Europe. And that is a mild way of expressing it. Now, we are on the verge of a blowout of the financial system. It could happen any moment. And if there is not a Glass-Steagall, then these fascist measures would go into effect and you would see a terrible catastrophe happening in Europe, because if you do to all of Europe what was done in Cyprus, well, I don't think it will go peaceful. I don't think it will be possible, because, you know, if you slash the real economy of countries like Italy, Germany, France, Denmark, and other countries, you know, you cause mass revolt and mass death.
You began your State of the World overview by speaking about the war danger. What is the connection between the war danger and the financial collapse, and also in light of what happened in Europe in the 1930s as opposed to United States in the 1930s under Roosevelt?
Well, the connection is very simple. You have to understand the concept of empire. I mean, when the Soviet Union disintegrated between 89 and 91, there would have been the possibility of creating a real peace order, because the enemy, so-called communism, no longer existed. And the Schiller Institute at that time had a real proposal how to create such a peace order, which was the idea to combine the population and industrial centers of Europe with those of Asia through the Eurasian Land Bridge, and that they have an economic platform for the countries of the Eurasian Land mass to work together in a peaceful way for the common benefit of everybody. Now, that policy is in part being implemented right now, after 24 years, by China, by Russia, by other participants like South Korea and Japan. But that was not accepted by the EU or by the United States in the period immediately after the collapse of the communist system. And that happened because the neocons in the United States around the old Bush administration, Bush Senior, who formed an alliance with Margaret Thatcher, and they decided, instead of using this historical chance, which the fall of the wall did represent, they instead decided to go for an Anglo-American world empire. And eliminate eventually, you know, all countries which would not, you know, agree to be submissive to this world empire, to eliminate their government through regime change. This was behind the policy against Iraq, Libya, and it's now still a threat against Syria, against Iran, and eventually against Russia and China. So at the same time, the so-called globalization started to go for an unlimited deregulation of the markets. Since the Soviet Union and the Comecon was no longer there, there was no reason to have any restriction, and they decided to go for globalization, total deregulation, which led to the present system of high-risk speculation. Now, if you understand that globalization is really another word for Anglo-American or Anglo-American Dutch empire, i.e. the connection or the conglomerate of all central banks, investment banks, hedge funds, insurance companies, private equity firms, and so forth and so on, that this system is identical with the idea of creating a world empire. Now, this financial system is now on the verge of collapse. I mean, that is not just our view, but, you know, people like Bill Gross of PIMCO, for example. PIMCO is the largest management fund for certain assets. He said recently that he is concerned that, you know, the world financial system could evaporate at one fine moment like a supernova when a star comes to its end. You know, it's a process where, you know, an enormous energy is released for a short period of time, but then the star dies. And the present exuberant behavior of the stock markets could be really compared to such a last moment of a supernova. Now, obviously, there are forces in the financial oligarchy who basically will not see that their system is coming to an end, and they're rather going for a nuclear brinkmanship with Russia, with China, then allowing that their system is simply evaporating relatively peacefully as it occurred with the Soviet Union. So the war danger comes immediately from this idea of an empire, the idea that, you know, there is a financial oligarchy which is determined to keep their system no matter what, even at the risk of the possible extinction of civilization. Now, obviously, our solution against that is we have to absolutely have the end of this casino economy, go to Glass-Steagall, like what Roosevelt did in the 30s. And, you know, today we have exactly the same choice like it existed in the 30s. In Europe, unfortunately, we decided to go the way of fascism, Brüning, austerity, then Schacht, then Hitler, Mussolini, Franco, Pétain in France, and out of that came World War II. Now, the danger is if we implement the same policies like Brüning, Schacht, Hitler, corporativism like Mussolini, then the danger is indeed World War III, and World War III would be probably the last world war, because if you use thermonuclear weapons, there is nobody going to be left. Now, the alternative, obviously, was what Franklin D. Roosevelt did in the United States, where he basically drew the conclusions out of the character of the financial system by, you know, ending the casino economy through Glass-Steagall, by introducing a Pecora Commission to investigate who was behaving in a criminal way in the banking crisis, and then basically creating a credit system, which at that time was the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, to issue credit for the real economy. And in that way, through the combination of the New Deal and later the Bretton Woods system, Roosevelt managed to to not only pull out the U.S. economy out of the crisis, but with the Bretton Woods system also created the basis for stable conditions in the world financial system for at least two decades to come. Now, these things are proven and tested, and therefore the movement for Glass-Steagall in the United States represents a true chance also for Europe to go that way and not fall into the danger of a fascism.
Can you explain more about the movement for Glass-Steagall in the United States and also in places like Switzerland, Belgium? Is it possible to actually get a Glass-Steagall bank separation and the other points of our three-point program, or is it just a pie in the sky?
Well, if it's a pie in the sky, then we have a pie in hell, because, you know, there is unfortunately, there are only two possibilities right now. One is a plunge into a dark age with the danger of a deterioration into a war, or we, in time, reorganize the system as Roosevelt did it. Now, many people in Europe don't really have a good understanding of what Roosevelt accomplished. But in the memory, in the common memory of the American population, this is different, because people have a family memory or memory of, you know, their culture, their education, that Roosevelt indeed ended the Great Depression of the 30s by implementing these measures. And given the fact that the United States right now is in an absolute terrible breakdown crisis, I mean, people were shocked a couple of weeks ago about the government shutdown, something which could happen again in a couple of weeks because the debt ceiling was only prolonged for a short period of time. So the idea or the possibility of a state insolvency of the United States really shook people up, not only inside the United States, but obviously internationally as well. But in the United States itself, you have the city of Detroit, for example, which is insolvent, and they are now negotiating the same kind of Cyprus model bail-in policy for Detroit, which, for example, would take from the city pensioners 95% of their pensions would just be taken away. And, you know, the kinds of settlements which are now being negotiated would not allow for these people to live. So you have an existential crisis between Obamacare, between Detroit. Time magazine had a cover story saying, is your city next? Because the indebtedness of most cities are not far behind Detroit. Then you have the cutting off the food stamps for 47 million Americans. I can only say there is a revolutionary situation where people in the United States really understand for the first time that these policies are killing them. As you know, we have organizing book tables, info tables every day in the streets. People call into our offices and they say, my God, I really understand this is threatening our lives. What can we do? What can we do to help? So there is a completely different situation in the United States than what people think. And I understand that in Denmark, where you have the beautiful country of Hygge, people may not be totally aware of it, but I can only emphatically say that in the United States you do have a revolutionary sentiment because people realize that, you know, unless they reinstitute the American Constitution and the ideas and values of the American Revolution and the ideas which are in the Declaration of Independence, which is one of the most beautiful documents ever written, unless this is being reasserted, this great country may not survive. And that creates a very, very special moment. And therefore, I think, you know, despite the fact that there is enormous pressure from Wall Street not to go for Glass-Steagall, I think that there is the potential that Glass-Steagall can be implemented. And, you know, in Europe, I think the country where this fight is the most advanced is Switzerland, where the SVP from the conservative side and the Socialist Party from the left side have made an alliance to call for the separation of the banks. And behind that is the understanding, which is very far spread among the population in Switzerland, that if one of the two big banks to fail, UBS, Union Bank of Switzerland, or Credit Suisse, would collapse, it would totally, totally destroy all of Switzerland, because these banks have volumes which are far, far larger than the entire GDP of the Swiss economy, and therefore, you know, the Swiss population, which is very Republican, you know, they are not, they have not yet, and they will not submit to the EU dictatorship because they have a Republican revolutionary tradition, which, you know, is a very good situation. I mean, the Swiss population is not, they are not underlings.
The tradition of
very proud,
the tradition of William Tell, you mean?
Sorry?
The tradition of William Tell, you mean?
I mean, not William Tell, because he's sort of a legendary figure, but the tradition of the play of Friedrich Schiller, of Wilhelm Tell. And many Swiss people identify with that Schiller play in this present moment.
You have spoken about a Shelley moment, the possibility of having a total shift in the sentiment of the population, which can generate political change. Can you explain that, please?
Yeah, the poet Shelley had this beautiful In Defense of Poetry, one of his writings, where he says that there are sometimes moments in history where the normal assumptions of the population are simply no longer possible. And these are the moments where people are able to understand profound conceptions about man and nature which they normally don't understand. And these are the moments of revolutionary change. And there is very clearly a pattern both in the United States and even in Germany and other countries that, you know, people all of a sudden start to understand things which they normally don't because they're too busy in having, you know, entertainment or holidays or some other thing. But in these moments, more profound conceptions come into the public conscience. Now, in the United States, it's what I said before. It's the combination of realization that Obama does everything what Bush did, just worse, that Obamacare is really killing people, that, you know, the whole country is in mortal danger. And in Germany, I think that the one thing which really did the most to cause such change is the NSA affair and the revelations of Edward Snowden. Because in Germany, this has brought forward all of a sudden a consciousness about the fact that in the entire post-war period, Germany had no sovereignty, and that what all of these foreign agencies like the NSA and the British GCHQ are doing in Germany, together with the BND, by the way, that all of this means that Germany has no sovereignty and that the total surveillance of all citizens of every communication means that there are no more liberties, there are no more civil rights. And, you know, there is right now a real understanding that cannot go on, that the combination of EU policies, you know, now the EU is today having a huge attack on the German export policy, basically, you know, trying to destroy the milk cow from whom they want to press more milk out. So there is right now an understanding that the present institutions are fundamentally against the interests of the normal citizen, and that the citizens have to start to defend their own rights, because otherwise they may not exist in a very short period of time. So I think it's a very pregnant moment, a moment in which one can cause changes, and, you know, where I think the ordinary citizen is called upon to stand up and fight.
We're not just speaking about the ideas of Roosevelt. We're also speaking about the population being able at a time like this to understand some of the great ideas of your husband, Mr. Lennon LaRouche, and his ideas of physical economy. In fact, one of the main reason why Tom has been able to predict the coming crash is because of his cooperation with Mr. LaRouche and his ideas in the United States. So could you explain what some of the most important ideas of the LaRouche's physical economy are, and how that and what image of man that is based on?
Yeah, I mean, the most important is really that money has no significance. I know that's shocking to most people, but my husband has said repeatedly that money is an idiot, because you can deploy it for whatever you want. It does not have an intrinsic value. Money is just a means, and that money as such does not have any value. You can see by the fact that in December 1923 in Germany, notes, Reichsmark, was the cheapest paper after the inflation had basically, collapsed the system, so that people would use Reichsmark notes as wallpaper because it was the cheapest paper. So now the only source of wealth in the concept of physical economy is the creativity of the population. And therefore, you know, a good government who would be oriented towards the common good would make sure that the creative powers of their own population are developed in the best possible way. Because only if you apply creativity, which leads to better understanding of the laws of the universe, the physical universe, and every time you make a discovery about these laws, you have scientific progress. And if you change this scientific progress into a technology and apply it in the productive process, then this leads to an increase not only of the productivity of the labor force, of the industrial capacity, but also to the economy at large. This leads to a better living standard, to a longer life expectancy, and, you know, basically just a progress of civilization. So the focus, therefore, has to be on the development of the creative powers of the labor force, starting with the schools, starting with, naturally, the parents, early education, the school system, the university system, and that way you can get a productive economy, which is naturally something completely different than what you have right now. I mean, right now the education system in Europe and in the United States, with very few exceptions, is geared to turn out illiterates. I mean, for example, in the United States, you have no books in the schools anymore. You have little computers or tablets, and then they print out one page for one hour, and no books. So obviously, the children who are being produced this way, in terms of students and so forth, they cannot build up a concentration span. They don't do experiments in chemistry or physics. It's just completely destruction of the cognitive powers. So physical economy, to the contrary, thinks about what are the necessary investments both in the own population and in the research and development to have a prolonged population, or to have a prolonged possibility for the population to reproduce itself on an extended basis from generation to generation. And that simply requires a high emphasis on higher energy flux densities, because the energy flux density in the production process is what determines the productivity. It determines what is the definition of raw materials, what is the mode of production, and that has to be always going upward and has to, you know, increase the command of man over nature. Now, that goes totally against the green paradigm, but the green paradigm is going to lead to the complete destruction of civilization, as you can see in the case of Germany right now, where, you know, all the major energy-intensive industries are leaving. They're investing elsewhere, in Turkey, in the United States, in China. And, you know, obviously the green paradigm is what is really killing also Africa, or, you know, the whole, you know, Western EU, which is entirely green. So basically what we are fighting for with the concept of physical economy is to bring the modes of production into conformity with the laws of the physical universe, which is developing from lower to higher energy flux density forms. And, you know, if we are successfully coming out of this crisis, we have to go back to a high emphasis on that, on science, on technology, and, you know, future developments.
And then as the last question, I would like to ask about that we don't only have an economic and a strategic crisis, but we also have a cultural crisis where much of the greatest classical culture is being ignored now. And just on Sunday, I believe, it was the birthday of Friedrich Schiller, which the Schiller Institute is named after. So I would like to ask you a combined question. What can Schiller teach us today? What inspiration can Schiller give us today? And also in terms of, we have here in Denmark a small country, we have a municipal election, we have single individuals who don't really think of themselves as being a real power of change in the world. So what do you say to these people, and what can Schiller teach us?
Now, the cultural crisis you refer to, I think, is demonstrated nowhere in a more obvious way than if you look at the so-called youth culture. I mean, when Schiller was discussing the reason why the French Revolution did not lead to a positive outcome, he said that it was because people had crippled emotions, and that therefore the development of the Empfindungsvermögen, I don't want to translate it with empathy, but it's something similar, that was the most important question of his time. Because, you know, only if people are emotionally capable to have a real comprehension of their environment, of their century, of their time, and have passion to change it, that they can act as responsible individuals in history. And that was clearly not the case in the French Revolution. So Schiller said the development of this Empfindungsvermögen, of this empathy, of this love for mankind is the most important. Now, if Schiller would be alive today and look how the children are looking, who in many cases are only the extensions of their PlayStation, totally autistic, playing their mindlessly violent video games of, you know, having no cognitive powers because everything is being Googled. Google has become a verb. People think they have real knowledge if they push search button and get out some stupid answer from some, you know, Wikipedia or some other source, which has nothing to do with conquering real knowledge. Anyway, so, you know, I could go on, you know, with examples of youth violence and you know, the whole terrible condition in which the children are. Now, Schiller discusses a lot of these things from the standpoint of how do you get people to not be based on their so-called sensuous experience, but to liberate the mind to be able to understand the ideas which are behind the appearances, and how the classical education and the classical art is helping people to become innerly free, that the inner person is what is counting. You are not dependent on some outside influences, but that you have this strength and ability to find the source of your own creativity and apply it, you know, throughout your life in always new situations. And this inner freedom is what Schiller was absolutely concerned with in his dramas, his poems, his theoretical writings. And therefore, you know, I think the studying of Schiller is about the most important and most, you know, gratifying thing you can do, especially when you combine it, you know, with the listening of classical music. But it has to be good performances, because nowadays what they call classical music is not always what we really mean by that. Now, I think Friedrich Schiller is right now one of the most important idea givers, because he has exactly that quality of setting the inner person free. And he's beautiful. His image of man is extremely positive and optimistic. He believes that every human being has the potential of becoming a genius, and his definition of a genius is the beautiful soul, that the person who does what is necessary with passion is free, and that is absolutely true. Now, the notion of the beautiful soul is a very almost sacred notion for me, and unfortunately now through the 30 years of work of the Schiller Institute, many people around the world appreciate this notion of the beautiful soul, which makes me very happy. Now, your question, what can a small country like Denmark do? Well, I think there are many examples in history where individuals totally alone changed history. Now, one of them in the recent public knowledge, obviously, is Edward Snowden, who has indeed caused quite a shake-up of the present world, which is still ongoing. But another example is, for example, Moses Mendelssohn, who is a person who lived in the 18th century in Germany, who came from a very backward environment in Dessau, I think it's Sachsen-Anhalt now. And he decided to go to Berlin, and he started to acquire knowledge, just everything, literature, music, geography, history. And in a very short period of time, he was known to be the Socrates of the 18th century and shaped what became the German classical period. He was one of the key influences preparing the grounds for that. And these two examples really are an example that there is no limit, that you don't have to be a big country, or you don't have to be, you know, a mass of people, but that every individual has the chance to intervene in history if you just take all the knowledge which is available. And I think Denmark has a, you know, a beautiful, you know, role to play, because you are relatively independent. You are not in the euro, which is a big advantage at this point. And you have a great classical tradition, which is linked also, among other things, to Schiller, because the Prince of Denmark was one of the persons helping Schiller to survive at a crucial crisis of his point. So I think that if the Danish population would recognize that because you still have a relatively good living standard as compared to Southern Europe, for example, that, you know, you don't have to fall into the abyss before you can start to, you know, even go for better goals in the future. So I think Denmark has a very, very good position to play a leading role in Europe and to acquire knowledge and contribute to the, you know, that mankind comes out of this terrible crisis. So since the Schiller Institute and Tom Gillisburg and you yourself are the representatives of these ideas, I really would like to propose to the voters to vote for you.
Yeah, as quoted in the very good interview with Tom today in the newspaper Information, he said it would be a political atomic bomb if he got elected, and would show that there are people in the country who believe that these ideas are very important for their future. So instead of having the war drive, let's have a political atomic bomb and get these ideas into the possibility of being realized through the elections.
Yes. So then have fun.
I want to thank you very, very much for taking the time to speak to our listeners, and we will be in touch with you further.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, I have...